This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I mean, almost all the parts of a bike that are metal are readily recyclable. They're usually either aluminum or steel, and both of those are easy to recycle. It's a question of, are they generating enough volume that someone in their area is going to come and pick them up?
This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from the research director of the Carbon Tracker Initiative, James Leeton. He discusses his organization's ongoing effort to inform the public about the quantities of fossil fuels and greenhouse gases various companies are emitting. His team's findings have been important talking points for Bill McKibben and 350.org's recent divestment campaign. Next, I speak with Graham Berg, the founder of Resource Revival, a small company that collects tons of bicycle parts each month from bike shops all over the U.S. to create beautiful, low-carbon footprint everyday products like picture frames and candle holders. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by James Leeton. He is the research director for the Carbon Tracker Initiative. James, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be here.
First, tell us what the mission of the Carbon Tracker Initiative is.
So we're looking to align the stock markets with the objectives to tackle climate change, basically, Alex.
And then let's go through some of the bullet points of how you've divided up this enormous goal. You focus mostly on the supply side of carbon, correct?
So I guess what we wanted to do was think about this as an issue of the stock of carbon that we've got, if you like. So the coal and oil and gas that's out there in the ground and under the sea, and what that all adds up to in terms of potential carbon emissions. And basically, we were set up because some people had this question in their heads. They really wanted to know, you know, if we burn all of that stuff that's out there, you know, in the Arctic and under the sea and across the world, how many degrees of warming would that take us to? And they thought, well, you know, someone must have done this research. There must be an answer out there. And they couldn't find it. There didn't seem to be a kind of clear answer for them to work with, and particularly in relation to their investments and understanding, you know, how much was on the stock exchange in New York, in London, in Hong Kong, in Sydney, and so on. So yeah, they eventually got some money together to do the research, and so we got some data together on reserves owned by all those companies listed on the stock exchanges, and turned them into carbon dioxide and worked out what would be emitted if we did burn them all going forward, and compared that essentially to a budget of what the limit is if we want a decent chance of achieving the 2-degree goal of limiting climate change. So essentially it's like, you know, having a financial budget that you can only spend this much, and how much can we burn to get us there.
So give us an example of a larger company like Chevron or Exxon, or which has a lot of fingers and a lot of pies, or a coal company like Arch Coal. How do you begin to approach them and then dig into their numbers?
Yeah, I mean, it's not rocket science. It's really just coming up with you know, the different types of oil. So we distinguish between, for example, tar sands in Canada, because that's, you know, more carbon intensive. So the emissions would be higher from extracting and burning that, as opposed to, you know, a kind of light crude from the Middle East, for example. So you adjust the carbon content in that way. And similarly, you have different types of coal as to whether it's a really kind of one of the sort of dirtier coals, or whether it's, you know, a slightly lighter one. So it's just, you know, using the data that's out there. It's not that difficult, you know. It spawned some understanding in terms of do the math, and it really is just doing some simple math in a way that we think should be mandatory for all the companies to do for us rather than us having to do it ourselves.
So you're basically holding the oil, gas, and coal companies accountable for the use of their products, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think having sort of worked out that, you know, essentially get the revenues that these companies get from selling their products are dependent on someone wanting them to burn at the other end. So if you limit the emissions, then that has a knock-on effect for the companies that they're no longer going to get all those revenues because there'll be less demand, the price may drop. And also, you know, there's a question, I think, really going forward, which is where the wasted capital comes in, is, well, if we know we've already got more than enough, then why does it make sense to keep pouring more and more capital into finding more reserves? You know, isn't that a waste of capital? And can we think of something better to do with it?
So Bill McKibben's organization, 350.org, and his colleagues have been focused quite a bit on divestment. But Carbon Tracker looks through a wider angle lens, if you will. Are you creating more leverage points for organizations like 350.org to begin to turn their glare towards in terms of divestment? Or are you helping more capital markets try to be more efficient with their assets?
I mean, I think the work that Bill and 350 have done has been great in terms of taking the issue out across America and getting more people thinking about it. And obviously, in order to do that, you need a simple message like divestment. I think in practice, you know, once you start talking to some of these big pension funds and the university funds that they've been targeting, you realize that they're operating within a system, and you know, they have, you know, processes and responsibilities that mean they can't just, you know, turn up on a Monday and say, yeah, we're going to sell all our coal stock. So I think that's where we're kind of coming in to be complementary, is, you know, understanding that not everyone can just make a moral choice to sell their coal or oil stocks, and they might need some more financial arguments to understand why it's actually becoming more of a risk to hold things like tar sands and coal, and help them understand why the value in those stocks is not as high as the market currently thinks it is.
Speaking of coal, there's been a lot of talk in that industry with carbon capture and storage, CCS. You, in your report, conclude that all this investment is pretty much a smokescreen. Is that fair to say?
I mean, I think it's just, it needs to be, you know, understood as not a silver bullet that's going to solve all the problems, that it's not a license to just burn as much as we want because we can just stick it all in the ground later. So, I mean, we used the International Energy Agency's own figures to work out, you know, what proportion of reserves, you know, it could cover, and it just, you know, it comes in too late, you know, too little too late, basically. And that means we could have used up the budget already by the time it's starting to make a difference. So, you know, it's still an option. It's still something that could make a big contribution in the long term. But I think we just, you know, want to highlight, you know, what the opportunities are now. And, you know, we already see that, you know, in some parts of the world, wind and solar are actually competing, you know, with fossil fuels. And, you know, we know these technologies work. They're becoming more and more certain, less and less risky. And that's where we see that, you know, investors need to understand that the coal and the oil is becoming more risky and the renewables is becoming less risky. So they need to start switching their investments accordingly.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with James Leeton. He's the research director for Carbon Tracker. People can go to carbontracker.org to see some of the work that he and his colleagues have done. It's kind of a silly question now that we have all these multinationals, but just looking at New York Stock Exchange companies and their proven reserves, how do they stack up against companies from other countries?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the surprising things, was just how much, you know, New York was going up in terms of over the last couple of years. You know, it's had more and more carbon listed on its exchange, and that's obviously as a result of the consolidation of the coal industry and finding shale gas and the oil price going up and, you know, more money being put into oil sands, and, you know, it's just heading in the wrong direction, basically. And, you know, we only know that because we've done these two reports over the last couple of years. But what we really want to see is the SEC, the regulator of that market, coming in and saying, well, we recognize that this is heading in the wrong direction and we need to be monitoring this and working out how to get it go the other way. And, you know, it's not, I guess, a purely U.S. issue because, you know, whilst a lot of the coal that's listed in the U.S. is located in the U.S. and has traditionally been burnt in the U.S., you know, they're now looking for export markets. And, you know, equally, you get a lot of overseas companies who come and list in New York. So you get a lot of, for example, you know, Chinese companies who are come and issue shares on the New York Stock Exchange for everyone to buy in the U.S., but all their reserves are, you know, over in Asia. So it's not just as simple as, oh, these are American reserves that Americans are going to use. It's a global system that, you know, could involve investors in one country and a stock exchange in another country and reserves, you know, somewhere else in the world that are then sold to another market. So it's the global trade of energy that we're looking at. It's not a simple, you know, country by country issue.
So we've heard a lot about Chinese imports of coal over the last few years, especially on the West Coast here in the U.S. How has that reflected in some of your research?
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly been looking at, obviously, the future of the coal market. And China is, you know, at the top of that waterfall, basically. And I think one of the most interesting things was China recently announced that they were going to cap their coal use at around the current level, around 4 billion tons, within the next couple of years. And that just doesn't fit with the graphs that everyone puts out in the coal industry, that all graphs go, you know, up and keep going up. You know, they're not expecting that demand to flatline. So I think that could have a real shock around the coal market, because obviously everyone's plan B is, well, we'll just export it to China, which is what we've seen in the US coal industry and the Australian coal industry and the South African coal industry. You know, they're all saying, well, we're just relying on, you know, China's growth and China's insatiable demand for this black stuff. So, you know, they can get caught out pretty quickly once China decides it's going to tackle, the air quality issue. It's, you know, it's the smog issue in Beijing that's really driving this, that has made it a political issue, that the people of China are really not happy with the quality of the air in their cities. And therefore, the government's recognized it needs to do something about this.
So you are getting into these numbers on a daily basis and know more about what faces us in our carbon future than most people. Does it make you hopeful or is it depressing?
No, I mean, I think the key thing is people, you know, start understanding where we need to get to. And I think it's been refreshing that, you know, some of the kind of financial actors that we've approached around this issue have actually been more engaged with it than we were expecting. So, you know, we've done a paper with Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency. We've seen research analysis from Citi in Australia, from HSBC in London. And we've seen, you know, pension funds, you know, from South Africa to Australia to Norway to the US kind of come to us and say, well, yeah, we can see that these numbers don't add up. So, you know, we want to start thinking about what that means for our investment.
I can imagine. He's the research director for the Carbon Tracker Initiative, James Leeton. James, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel so happy. But mostly you just make me mad. Baby, you just make me mad. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on. Your pale blue eyes.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we remember the incomparable Lou Reed, who died at the age of 71. I'm joined next by Graham Berg. He's the founder of Resource Revival. Graham, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
This company's been around for almost two decades, right?
Yeah, started officially in 94, although I did actually get the first idea for some product concepts back in 1991.
And you make functional art from recycled bike parts. Why don't you explain what kind of epiphany you had in starting this company and the journey that the company has taken in the last couple decades?
Yeah, so I moved to Portland, Oregon in 1990 looking for a career in the environmental field, and I was also an avid cyclist. So I was bike commuting in Portland before that was hip. And one day I was biking to my recycling job and got a flat tire. And I took out the tube to patch it, which I'd already patched about a dozen times. And I thought, I literally just thought, huh, I could patch this, but what else? I mean, what are people doing with their inner tubes that they don't patch? So over the next couple of years, I started interviewing bike shops and tinkering around with ideas and eventually came up with a bunch of products made out of bicycle inner tubes and launched the company in 94 with an order from REI for a strap called a tube tie. And it is evolved from there, fairly quickly evolved from the straps and more functional utilitarian items to more decorative items and starting to use the metal parts from the bike.
Mostly the chains, right?
Yeah, we started actually with the bicycle gears and hubs and rim sections. And today, most of our products are made from bicycle chain because it has turned out to be the most dynamic material. I mean, it's sort of like a line. You can draw with it. So you can draw a circle, you can draw a square. So we have picture frames, we have clocks, you know, a variety of different things. But we do some really surprising things with chain too. We make a bowl. It's a decorative bowl that's a spiral of chain that we liken to a indigenous culture woven basket. They're beautiful. We have a bottle opener that has a chain handle that's still flexible so that it's sort of wiggly and floppy one way, which is kind of fun to play with. But then when you go to open the bottle, it's rigid in that axis.
So you're sourcing chains from all over the country, correct? And selling them nationally as well, I assume.
Yeah, so we collect bike chain from about 500 different bike shops. There's about 4,000 bike shops in the country, not including places like Walmart, Target that sell bikes as well. And so we're collecting from a little over 10% of the actual bike shops in the country.
And how does that work logistically? You obviously don't send a resource revival team member to every bike shop around the
right.
country.
Well, yeah, so there's my background was in recycling education. That was the job I was biking to when I got the idea. And what the research really showed is you have to make recycling really easy for people to do it, and you have to make it consistent. And so what we do is we just say to the bike shops, all you have to do is pick any old box. Bike shops have plenty of cardboard boxes because they're receiving parts all the time, helmets or whatever. And they just pick a box and they fill it with chain. And when the box is full, they tape it closed, weigh it, and call or email us. And then we use something called a UPS call tag, which is sort of an inverted shipping label. Instead of us putting a label on a box here, we digitally send it to the UPS pickup driver in their location, and they show up the next day with a label, grab the box, and bring it back to us. So it's like a retrieval system.
And you're focusing now mainly on the chains, but what do most bike shops do for recycling or throwing away their parts? And what did they do with their chains before solutions like yours came around?
Right, that's a great question. So what I know mostly is from my on-the-ground research when I started the company, which is now close to 20 years ago. But even in Portland, Oregon, which was renowned for their recycling efforts, a lot of bike shops were just throwing everything in the dumpster. It's just simpler. And I think anybody who does household recycling knows that it does take more work to separate stuff. Even if it's really easy and clear, it's still, you know, that one decision, which bucket does it go into or which bin. So a lot of bike shops are throwing stuff away. And I would say, you know, especially when we're collecting from places like Colorado, Nebraska, whatever, those are way less likely to be recycling the parts. I mean, almost all the parts of a bike that are metal are readily recyclable. They're usually either aluminum or steel, and both of those are easy to recycle. It's a question of, are they generating enough volume that someone in their area is going to come and pick them up? Because most curbside recycling programs aren't as simple as, you know, throw your scrap metal in them. So before, most they either did nothing, it went in the dumpster, or they had like a mixed metal bin and they had some scrapper who would come by and pick through it, usually picking out the aluminum, which is a much higher value scrap material. But also it's important, we do collect and still use some other bike parts, notably bicycle wheel rims. But because wheel rims are so big, they don't really conveniently pack into a cardboard box for shipping. And so we collect all of those from a couple scrappers in Portland, Oregon, which is about an hour from where we are, just because it would be too complex. The chain, what's really nice about the chain for the bike shops is it packs as densely as possible. I mean, chain is about the most dense material coming off of a bike, whereas a bike wheel rim is mostly air. And so we have sort of local sources for our other materials that we collect.
Jenny said when she was just 5 years old, there was nothing happening at all. Every time she puts on the radio, there was nothing going down at all. Not at all. Then one fine morning she puts on a New York station. You know she don't believe what she heard at all. She started shaking to that fine, fine music. You know her life was saved by rock.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder of Resource Revival, Graham Berg. So, Graham, you explained that you were a bike enthusiast and had commuted before you started this company, but are there any limits to the vehicle in terms of recycling? Would you be able to use motorcycle chains or other parts from other vehicles down the road? Or is this is part of the mission for it to be another way for people to view the value of bicycles?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. When I started the company, I named it Resource Revival because I wanted it to potentially cover any kind of resource that we wanted to revive. What we found over the years, we did introduce some computer parts into the product line. We did introduce some auto tire rubber into the line, some building parts. And each time we did that, some of those things have stuck. So, for example, we have a clock called the hybrid wall clock. That's a very dominant bicycle chain ring. But then behind it is a cool gold-colored disc. And if you didn't know what it was, you wouldn't know what it was. But it's a computer hard drive, so it might have someone's old emails or spreadsheets or whatever on there. But it's there. It's decorative. We're not. What we found is with products that were dominantly computer parts, nobody was interested in them. So I think people like bicycles. Bicycles have a really positive association, and they have an aesthetic beauty that computer parts don't have. But I'm not opposed to, and we have some prototypes of motorcycle chain products. I think it would be great. The reality is, with a business that is dealing with a waste stream, it's almost like we're a mining or a we're like a natural resource extraction business. We have a waste stream, which is the flow of the parts from the bike shops. And if we wanted to switch or add in, let's say, motorcycle chain, the bike shops can't provide us with that. So we'd have to switch to a whole new forest, a whole new mine, so to speak, which would be the motorcycle dealers, and figure out that system and start getting that flow and dial that flow in so that it's not too little. So in other words, if we start selling the products, we can actually fill orders. We have enough chain for that, and not too much, so we're not suddenly overflowing with packages of motorcycle chain flowing in. So it's definitely something we're considering. And it really gets to a question that you haven't asked, but that I'm fascinated with as a business owner, is what is the right size for your business? And a lot of people believe you're just trying to grow, make more money. And we're really not. We're at a good size.
Can you give us a snapshot of the size of the company?
Yeah, well, it's complicated in that we don't disclose financial numbers, but we do, and we only have 7 employees. But I'll say this, is 8 years ago, we had 10 employees, and since then, we've tripled sales. So we've been able to triple sales while reducing our staff by 40%. And we have done that through a variety of means, better products, more efficient designs. You know, instead of a product taking 12 different parts, it takes 4. instead of a product having, you know, one highly, highly trained person have to know how to make it, there, our stuff is just simpler. Arguably maybe less artistic too.
Well, that was another question I had, is how much labor are some of these things seem pretty laborious. I imagine the bike chain bowl is probably the toughest to make, but some of them, like the bottle opener, might be not exactly reinventing the wheel, so to speak.
Yeah, those are two great examples. So the bike chain bowl on one hand is made by a very talented welder, and each one takes 100 welds. I mean, it's a work of art. It's craft. There's no doubt it's a craft product, and that's how it's marketed, and that's what it is.
And it's almost $100. You're not just getting something from Bed Bath & Beyond.
Right. It's definitely more of like a craft store, gallery kind of product. On the other end, like the bottle openers are actually mostly assembled at a sheltered workshop in Hood River, Oregon, that employs developmentally disabled adults. So they're a nonprofit. And basically to assemble the bottle opener involves, you know, minimal manual dexterity. And so what we've found is that, you know, we pay them the same we would pay someone working in-house to do it, but we're able to provide the social benefit of working with them and also to expand our workforce without having to hire people. So that's a real win-win there.
So you were talking about how the motorcycle idea, it would work, except that so many of your relationships are carved through the bike retail world. Could you give us an idea of the divide between retail and wholesale for your company?
Yeah, so wholesale so we actually have three parts of our business. We have wholesale, which is where we sell, you know, a store in Santa Cruz or Boulder, Colorado or Chicago or Asheville, North Carolina, will order, you know, 4 picture frames, 2 clocks, 2 dozen bottle openers, et cetera, and then they'll merchandise those for sale for people who walk in to their store. We also sell direct through a website called rebike.com. to direct to people who want to order from us. And then we actually have a pretty large section of sales, which is to companies like Clif Bar or Google or the American Diabetes Association or you know, anyone with a bike shop that wants to promote it. And they can buy our stuff with their logo or message on our product. So the bottle opener, they could laser engrave Google on there. Google did that for their street level maps in Austin, Texas. And so that's actually a pretty big part of the business. And it's actually a lot of fun. It involves the products that are less artistic, but it's really cool when the National Multiple Sclerosis Society's New York City AIDS ride, or sorry, the MS ride, we also sell to the AIDS rides as well. It gets a little confusing. But these mission-based companies, we give them a great price on a lot of medals, and then there are 10,000 riders at the finish line all get this medal that's made in the USA. It's made from recycled bike parts. And so there's just a little bit more meaning to it, I think, than the average token you get from participating in a ride like that.
And you also give 1% of your profits to charity as well, correct?
We do. Well, actually, not 1% of profit, 1% of sales. So even if we've lost money in the year, we have this idea that we're going to give away 1% of sales. It's just a fundamental commitment. And that's mostly goes to local schools in the area where our employees live, but also goes to some bicycle advocacy organizations and a couple other organizations as well.
People should go to resourcerevival.com to find out more about the company. Graham Berg, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Charles Erland and Lou Reed. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.